It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we thought we'd listen back to some of our favorite News Buzz conversations from the past few months. Later in the program, how crows are even smarter than we thought. Also, an interesting conversation with an Academy Award-winning Disney animator. He happens to also be an Iowa native, Don Hall. And did you know this? The butterfly stroke was invented right here in Iowa. We'll find out how, and I'll actually jump into a pool later in the program. But first, we all have chins. There are all different types of chins. You may like your prominent chin, or perhaps wish yours was smaller or shaped differently. Females tend to have smaller, rounded chins, while male chins tend to be bigger, more square, or even have a cleft. But here's the really big question. Why? Why do we have chins? It turns out the debate over why humans have chins and other species don't has been going on for decades, and there have been developments on this front this year. Back in April, I talked about these developments with Bob Franciscus. We've had him on the program before. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa and part of a team behind research in a new paper published online in the Journal of Anatomy.
The argument we favor is what we would refer to as a spatial argument. If you consider the fact that modern humans have relatively small faces compared to our ancestors, there are several features in the face and the craniofacial complex, as we call it overall, that seem to be secondary consequences of having a less projecting and a less massive face. And we think the chin is one of these features. So as the face got smaller in later human evolution, say around 100,000 years ago or even less than that, the face is not projecting as much through time. And what is happening is the chin is remaining in a more forward position or an anterior position, as we refer to it, because the tooth portions of the jaw have retracted. And so the chin, in a way, is left out there as a spatial secondary consequence.
Mm. And this ties in with a paper that you were involved in from last year.
That's right. This was a paper published in Current Anthropology and involved myself and a series of researchers from Duke University. We were very interested in this dynamic of facial reduction, and we were interested in the social dynamics that might be behind it. As I've mentioned, a lot of people have talked about facial gracilization or facial downsizing in human evolution as being a function of maybe some kind of technological change where we are cooking food or where we are processing food in a way that we don't need such large muscles and such large teeth and so on. By and large, if you want to explain modern humans, those explanations don't seem to fare so well. Mm-hmm. And what we favor instead is an idea that beginning roughly around perhaps 80,000 years ago, modern humans really started downsizing their faces in a way that wasn't even present in the earliest modern humans that emerged in the fossil record about 200,000 years ago. And that's because those earliest modern humans in some ways were still behaving like archaic humans or pre-modern humans. But beginning in Africa about 80,000 years ago and then extending to populations that leave Africa and colonize the rest of the world, we seem to have some fundamentally different changes occurring where groups are more pro-social. They seem to have larger extended networks, sort of group networks across the landscape, and are less we can see them as less isolated groups living by themselves and depending only on themselves. And we argue that in order for this to happen, humans had to become, and especially males, had to become less aggressive and more willing to tolerate, especially males from other groups, so that male movement between groups would be possible. And we think a smaller face, which, by the way, is mediated by testosterone levels, is probably what was going on as an honest signal of less aggression.
Okay, not much time left, Bob, but does that also explain in this theory why men tend to have squarer jaws and chins and women tend to have more rounded, smaller chins?
Not so much, because that's an explanation related to sexual dimorphism. Fundamentally, both females and male modern humans have chins. But the shape differences are a function of the fact that males do have still have larger faces than females. And what's important here is that both males and females have considerably smaller faces than our pre-modern ancestors. And that's why we refer to this as facial feminization, because males today are much more feminine relative to males and to some degree even females in terms of our earlier our ancestors.
Okay, so the findings of this new published paper in the Journal of Anatomy, together with a paper from last year in Current Anthropology, does this settle the great chin debate of where human chins came from, you think?
I don't think it settles it. Some of these debates will probably never be settled entirely, but I think it moves us forward. It gives us a new set of parameters and a new set of ideas to look at. And certainly other researchers are going to take a look at our data and perhaps, you know, try to replicate our study. And I hope that it continues to stimulate the kind of discussion that it has so far.
Stimulating conversation with you always. Bob Franciscus, professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa, part of a team. He's together with a team of researchers at the University of Iowa College of Dentistry. A new paper published online in the Journal of Anatomy talking about the possible origins of human chins. Bob, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Ben.
It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, actually a special edition of our Friday News Buzz. We're listening back to some of our favorite conversations from the past few months. Here's one that actually took me out of the studio. I went to the University of Iowa's Campus Recreation and Wellness Center that was built back in 2010. It's a huge facility with a very impressive pool. And there I spoke with the head coach of swimming and diving at the University of Iowa, Mark Long, about the invention of the butterfly. Yes, the butterfly stroke was invented right here in Iowa in the 1930s. Let's go back to that conversation from September of 2014.
Well, the University of Iowa has a tremendous swimming history, going back even before the field house being built. And when that field house was built, it was just a remarkable facility, one of the world's largest indoor pools. And so swimmers were attracted here. They also had outstanding coaching at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the advent of the butterfly stroke is interesting in that it sprang from the breaststroke. How did that happen and who was involved?
Well, it did come from the breaststroke. And what they were doing is they were doing an over-the-water recovery of the breaststroke, where typically the hand stayed under the water. And then that morphed into not kicking at all and having the dolphin kick action.
Okay, and so the advantage then of the recovery of the stroke being above water rather than underwater is you have less drag, or what is that?
Yeah, it was faster at the time. Yeah, less drag, faster. And there's a lot of different stories, as you could imagine, with the development of the stroke. And there were a lot of different. The breaststroke, even at that time, didn't have a one pull, one kick rule underwater. You could swim underwater at one point the whole way. So just coming up from air. So at the time, there's a little bit of a Wild West with some of these strokes.
Okay. So two names connected with Iowa that are connected with the development of the butterfly as a stroke. One name is Armbruster, and the other one is Sieg. Tell us about those two individuals.
Yeah, David Armbruster is a legendary coach in the swimming community in the International Swimming Hall of Fame. He coached here for over 40 years and had many Olympians and some famous assistant coaches, one being Doc Councilman, who went on to coach at Indiana, Mark Spitz, and so on. And he worked with a swimmer named Jack Sieg in the 30s that did develop the butterfly stroke.
And the arms were developed separately from the legs?
Well, again, it was an over-the-water recovery with the arms and then just having a dolphin kick action. But it was illegal at the time, and it was illegal until the 1950s.
Because they were entering competitions as the breaststroke, an alternative form of the breaststroke.
Exactly. We know now from watching the Olympics and Mark Spitz and so on that there are four main competitive strokes. It's interesting when you look back, there was just three, and they even had 300 medley relays. We have a 300 medley relay that was NCAA champion here, and the missing event is the fly.
So we now have four competitive strokes. Everyone listening thought perhaps there were only ever four strokes, but when did the butterfly stroke become competitive as a part of, you know, everyday swimming competition?
Yeah, it was in the 1950s, and there continued to be controversy even all the way up until the 80s because you're actually quicker underwater. Like I mentioned in the breaststroke, they could stand her. They finally made the rule one pull, one kick. Well, in the butterfly and the backstroke, you're quicker underwater as well. And until 88, you could stay underwater the entire way and be faster. So they put a limit of 15 meters. So it is still evolving. But the remarkable thing was that those two did, they went back and had developed it, had tried to get it going. They were disqualified at the time. And then as legend would have it, they came back and recognized them now as the founders of the butterfly stroke.
Mark, I understand part of the story behind the butterfly is some lore attached to something that happened at the field house called the Dolphin Show.
Yeah, it was the Dolphin Show. There was a dolphin club, a dolphin fraternity, and they did this show for decades. And it was more popular, from the people I've talked to involved, more popular than homecoming. They had a parade. They had a court. And it was a mixture of vaudeville, synchronized swimming, competitive swimming. It was a fundraiser for our team.
But the Dolphin Show didn't have a direct tie into the dolphin kick and the butterfly?
Well, I have heard stories on that there was, they would light people on fire.
Light people on fire?
And have them jump off a high board from the ceiling of the field house. I'm not sure how that would go over nowadays, but I think it was, so it was a wild show, and it was, it was a hot ticket in town. The place was packed, but they would have somebody swim the entire length, which was 50 yards at the time, of that pool underwater. And, you know, legend would say that that's where they started developing the dolphin kick, when they were doing that underwater swimming.
Well, Mark Long, I'm an avid swimmer. I work out several times a week, but not with the butterfly. I'm a freestyle swimmer. And would you care to take a crack at least attempting, and this attempting to have me try the butterfly and see what happens?
Absolutely. I think it'd be fun. Should I get the lifeguards, or are we good?
I think that would be a very good idea. So standing by the edge of the pool, I'm gonna get in, Mark, and just do a lap of freestyle, just to loosen up, and then you can instruct me, all right?
Sounds great.
Okay. A little warmed up, Mark. So... what do I need to do? How do I start off learning the butterfly?
I'm a little concerned how tired you are already. I don't want to... No. Well, let's start with the kick. So you want to start underwater with the dolphin kick. And right away, you know, work on that kind of a knees down. And let's see you do a dolphin kick, and let's come right up. Normally, I would go into a series of drills, right arm, left arm, but I think we just go right into it here.
We just go right into it. So I'm going to just imagine I'm a masterful butterfly stroker and give you the whole package.
Yeah, so I'd go right up. Let's see what you got here. Start off with some kicks underwater and come right up and do a breakout. Okay. Just do four strokes to start with. Okay. It's not bad. You know, he's staying on top of the water. He's working a little harder than he has to, but I think we can work on that.
Well, I don't know how that looked to you, but it felt like I was fighting the butterfly, Mark.
Yeah. You're fighting a little bit, but I see some promise there, and a few pointers. Remember, we're land animals, so you need to adapt to the water a little bit. And humans are very inefficient in the water, so the more efficiency you can bring, including just off the wall, is a freebie. All right, so if you just streamline better, get your hands into a more of a streamline, your arms in a streamline position, you're gonna go a lot further, and your kicks are gonna be more effective. And that's really true, I think, with swimming in general. Just remember that humans are very inefficient in the water, and the more efficiency we can add to it, that doesn't even really take extra physical activity. I'd say, all in all, that's pretty good.
Okay, well, thank you for saying that, at least. Now, a butterfly stroker, a fly, does that develop different muscles than muscles that are developed with the other strokes?
Well, yeah, and by the way, we don't have a race that's short, so I think you might have to get a little bit better to come back. But, you know, it does and it doesn't. I'd say for freestyle, for breaststroke, there is a similar arm action that's happening at that front catch. So We would work on the efficiency on it, okay, more so. Now, if you go into the 200 butterfly a little bit longer, we are working a little bit more of the, you know, I hate to say conditioning aspect, but strength, it's a very powerful stroke. Strength underwater, we do a lot of strength training and technical work.
That was a chance I got out of the pool and went to the University of Iowa's Campus Recreation and Wellness Center to try the butterfly. It was not pretty, folks. Speaking there with University of Iowa head swimming and diving coach Mark Long. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River. We're listening back to some of our favorite conversations on NewsBuzz from the past few months. Earlier this year, the Academy Awards shined the national spotlight on an Iowa native. Big Hero 6 won Best Animated Feature Film. Here's a clip from it. It's a scene from the beginning of the movie where the protagonist, appropriately named Hero, interacts with the soft robot Baymax.
You have fallen.
You think?
Ow.
On a scale of one.
Ow.
On a scale.
Ah.
On a scale.
No.
On a scale of 1 to 10. On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your pain?
0.
It is all right to cry.
No.
Crying is a natural response to pain.
I'm not crying.
I will scan you for injuries.
Don't scan me.
Scan complete.
Unbelievable.
You have sustained no injuries. However, your hormone and neurotransmitter levels indicate that you are experiencing mood swings, common in adolescence. Diagnosis? Puberty.
Whoa, what?
Okay, there's the protagonist of the film, appropriately named Hero, interacting with that soft robot, Baymax. Things falling off the shelf if you're wondering what he was grunting about there. Well, the winner, we are joined now by Don Hall, a Disney animator and Glenwood, Iowa native, one of the directors of the Oscar award-winning Big Hero 6. Don Hall, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Ben. Appreciate it.
What have these last few days been like? I imagine you've just been in heaven.
Yeah, we haven't come down from cloud nine yet. It still feels almost like a dream, to be honest with you. You know, it's so much, you know, work went into the film. This crew, our studio is just full of amazing artists, and they worked so hard on this movie. So, you know, really, the Oscar really is a testament to them, and it's been, yeah, it's been really cool. We're actually going to have a big party around 4 o'clock today for everybody in the studio to gather around the Oscars and have a good time.
All right. So those who've seen it know why they love your movie, Big Hero 6. The Academy certainly knows why it loves your movie. What do you love most about the film?
Well, for me, it really connected to sort of passions that I had as a kid. I mean, I've always loved Disney animation. That's I said to my mom and dad, I think when I was 5, I was going to work at Disney animation. But I also love Marvel Comics, and it's where I really learned to draw and tell stories through drawings. So this was really a passion project for me. I pitched this idea of doing sort of a Marvel, taking a Marvel idea and making an animated film to John Lasseter, and he got very excited, and it led us on the path to here. So it really does connect to something deep into my childhood. But I'm most proud of not just the comedy in the movie. It's very funny, and there's a lot of really great action scenes because it's based on a comic book. But there's a lot of really deep felt emotion in the movie. And, you know, when audiences, I think that surprises people. You know, they go in thinking it might be sort of a comic book movie or a comedy, but they come out having cried probably 3 to 4 times. And that's very gratifying for a mm-hmm. filmmaker.
How do you know that's going to happen when you direct it? Do you feel those moments in the studio, especially when you're not working with actors? Like, you know, you've got live actors there. You can feel that when you're on a studio set. Something's going on. But how does that happen in animation?
Yeah, it's a little harder in that, you know, everything is it's harder to be spontaneous in animation because everything's so thought out over the course of 3.5 years. But that said, we still record actors in a recording booth, and you can tell a lot of times in the recording booth if you're laughing at it, it's chances are it's going to be funny to other people, or if it's moving you emotionally in the recording booth when you hear it, chances are it'll move people emotionally. But we also watch the movie probably, I don't know, like 7 to 8 times over the course of a movie's life, where we storyboard the whole thing. We do temporary sound effects and dialogue and everything, and we watch it as a group. And so you kind of test things out over the course of the film, and so you get a pretty good idea what you think is working, and it really helps us kind of hone these stories.
Mm-hmm. You've been at Disney since 1995, is that right?
That is right.
Wow, you've seen a lot of change in animation, haven't you?
I certainly have, yes.
So is it all for the better?
Oh, I think so. I think, I'm a student of sort of Disney history as well, and, you know, we all are, and anybody who loves Disney, you know, you become just enamored with the legacy and the history of the place, and I think this is the best time in the history of the studio. I mean, we're just on fire right now. We got a lot of just the talent level that we have in this building is amazing, and the crew, they're just, everybody's so motivated. So it's kind of like playing for the Lakers, you know, back in the 80s, or, you know, pick your Yankees dynasty or whatever. You know, you grow up loving this team, and then you get to play for them and play at a time when there's just a lot of talent that surrounds you. And so it's a great time to be here.
Mm-hmm. Talk about where animation has to go technically in the future. It's come so far since you've mm-hmm. been at Disney. What's left?
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, we pushed it on this film. It was very important to me at the onset to get a look that was very rich and detailed and had really cinematic virtues about it. You know, we wanted the lighting to be very cinematic and the camera moves to be very cinematic and evoke sort of live action. And in fact, they had to develop a brand new software system for us to do that called Hyperion. And so we really pushed it on this movie, and I'm very happy with the results. And so it's hard to say where animation can go. I think there's still room for hand-drawn. Two of the films that were nominated for Oscars this year were hand-drawn animated films. And so mm-hmm. that tells me that there's still, you know, an appetite for it. So, but it always boils down to just story. You know, mm-hmm. what is, you've got to tell a great story. It doesn't really matter about the medium. It matters about the story.
As I said, Big Hero 6 won Best Animated Feature Film in the Academy Awards. I spoke in February with Don Hall, Disney animator, Glenwood, Iowa native, and one of the directors of the Oscar award-winning film Big Hero 6. And in just a moment, we'll be back with more of this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And when we do come back, we'll find out how crows are even smarter than we thought. New research on that. We'll visit the University of Iowa's Mobile Museum, see the latest exhibits in that. And that's traveling around the state, so you may get a chance to see those exhibits. This will be a preview. And Kyle Munson with the latest on the Field of Dreams. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, listening back to some of our favorite NewsBuzz conversations from the past few months. Coming up in just a moment, we'll visit and step into the University of Iowa's Mobile Museum for this year and see the latest exhibits. Also, Kyle Munson with the latest on the Field of Dreams. But first, those of us interested in such things No crows. Yes, the birds are smart animals. And now, some new research shows that crows are even smarter than we thought. Ed Wasserman is a psychology professor at the University of Iowa. He's corresponding author of a study involving the University of Iowa, finding that crows join humans, apes, and monkeys in exhibiting advanced relational thinking. I had this conversation with him back in January of this year.
This new study concerned abstract reasoning, the ability to go beyond, if you will, the specific stimuli in question and to access a higher order representation or rule or regularity, specifically in this particular project, the relation between relations. Now, this is a somewhat abstract idea and sometimes difficult to communicate, but I'll do my best to do so.
Please do.
So if I were to show you an apple and an orange, and you were to say, those things are different, or I were to show you two apples, and you'd say those two things are the same, you would have engaged in what we would call first-order relational perception. That is, you can perceive the sameness or the differentness of a pair of stimuli. What we effectively are asking in this project is whether crows can appreciate the relation between relations. So, for instance, let's now slip to letters of the alphabet to make this a little bit clearer. If I were in the center of your computer screen to show you a pair of letters, A and A, and then on either side I would show you the letters B and B or C and D, the question would be, which is the better match to AA? Is it BB or CD? Notice there's no identity, but the relation of B to B is the same as the relation of A to A, in which case then BB would be the better choice than CD. You would be matching the relation to that had been exemplified in the initial or center pair of letters.
And that's what you mean by advanced relational thinking.
Exactly. And this was something that had been deemed for centuries to separate humans from animals, the ability to perceive higher order cognitive relationships. People like Descartes and Locke, famous French and British philosophers, had said that there's a vast gulf in intelligence between humans and animals, and they said it was largely attributable to the fact that animals didn't have ideas or didn't have the ability to form abstract notions. And what research in our science has gone on now to show is that, indeed, such luminaries as Locke and Descartes were dead wrong. In other words, this research is something to crow about.
So I'm trying to picture the research here. How was it designed? You have crows looking at images?
So the crows are in a small cage, and in front of them, the experimenter slides a tray containing three cards. The center card has two geometric shapes, and each of the side cards has two geometric shapes. And the crow, by choosing one or the other of the side cards, tells us whether or not it perceives the relation between relations. And the crows very adeptly did this.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes the demonstration all the more remarkable is they weren't trained to do this. Now, you might have imagined something like this, even with people, would require a great deal of assiduous and methodical training. But in fact, the crows spontaneously did this after they had been trained on a task, a much easier task, simply to choose the side card that had the same shape or the same color or the same size or the same number of items as the center card.
Are crows' brains different than other bird brains?
Crows have the remarkable brains. They are the, if you will, the bees of, well, among birds, they have the largest and most intricate brains. Bees have the largest and most intricate brains among insects, and the apes have the largest and most intricate brains among mammals. Perhaps dolphins have something approximating that kind of brain, but much of it is devoted to echolocation, so it's really somewhat difficult to tell.
Mm. So you mentioned humans. Humans, apes, monkeys, how do crows then compare in relation to those categories in terms of intelligence?
Well, intelligence, even among people, is a difficult thing to scale, and I would be the last one to endeavor to do so. But what I would say is that as we explore more and more species, more animals cross this threshold of abstract thought. And certainly the fact that crows are the first among birds to be able to show this is perhaps not a surprise. Maybe they really are special among birds. But until we study more different species, we'll never really know.
Okay, before we have to go very quickly, Ed Wasserman, this study builds on your previous studies and other previous work with crows. What comes next? What do you want to answer?
Well, we'd like to see how flexible the birds are. So in this particular design, although it's somewhat difficult to communicate this relational matching to sample, we'd like to know whether, in fact, the birds are capable of the opposite, the logical opposite, to choose the relation that doesn't match. You could call that relational mismatching to sample.
Mm.
And the reason why that might be interesting is there might be something special about sameness. Maybe there's something that grabs the crow's attention and sees that a BB pair is much more like an AA pair than a CD pair. Maybe that's something special, and we'd sort of like to know that.
Okay, Ed Wasserman, psychology professor at the University of Iowa. A new study involving the University of Iowa showing that crows join humans, apes, and monkeys in exhibiting what is called advanced relational thinking. Ed, have you started your campaign to ban this expression, bird brain?
Yes, I prefer the expression brainy bird, if you prefer.
Thank you, Ed.
Bye-bye.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and I'm standing at the moment outside the State Hygienic Laboratory in Coralville. Last spring, the University of Iowa debuted a museum on wheels, and maybe you had a chance to visit it. It was all around the state last year. It's been traveling, bringing natural history and other fascinating aspects of Iowa history to Iowans, and I'm standing outside of the Museum on Wheels. It's the mobile museum educator, J.C. Gillette. Hi, J.C.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Before we step inside, so that people can recognize it when they see it at a fairgrounds or wherever, on Ragbri, I know it's there. This is a very large refurbished RV, I guess you would describe it as.
That's the best way to describe it, yes. It's a 38-foot Winnebago RV that is all decked out in black and gold with Dare to Discover and Mobile Museum all across it. Plus, we also have our three physical exhibits, posters for those on the outside. So
let's step inside and we'll look at get a quick overview of the exhibits this year. It's been completely redone since last year. So if you saw it last year, there are three new exhibits. There's nothing in there from last year. We're going to be talking about water underground, the science of Iowa's most essential resource, Hawkeyes in space, space exploration at the University of Iowa, and Iowans in World War II. Let's step inside, huh, JC?
All right.
Okay, you've brought me over to physics and space research. We're talking about Iowa, University of Iowa's role in space research. Tell us about it.
You can't think of space research without thinking of Iowa. So we decided to start with James Van Allen, all the way back in the 1950s with the Low-Key Raccoons. We have one of the innards of one of those raccoons on display. Then we travel along the timeline, kind of through various launches and missions that the university was part of, all the way up until the present, with the Van Allen probes, which are dedicated to James Van Allen. They are studying the Van Allen radiation belts more.
So what's interesting about this exhibit is, I see here, is you actually see these rocket tubes. You see James Van Allen in archive photos holding up these probes, these rockets. But here you have displayed the innards, so it's not often you get to see inside a probe with all the electronics that go into it.
Exactly, and that's why they are highlighted as such. Because you always see the outside, but it's cool to take a look at the inside and really see what makes it work. And the nice thing about the Explorer 1 rocket inside we have is if you look close, you can actually see a battery from the 1950s.
Okay, yes, it says Eveready Battery. Looks like something from my childhood, perhaps. Okay, just next door in this mobile museum is a tribute, an exhibit that talks about Iowans in World War II, JC.
Yes, so we have, as with the Special Collections, partnered to bring you the story of several different people through World War II, but we focus around two people. That's Lloyd and Laura Davis and their correspondence throughout the war. Well, he was over there, but she was back here in Iowa, still working, still running the household, and so it's a neat correspondence. You see there are much more of her letters than his, and that's just because he always didn't have time to write. In one of his letters, he actually talks about he hasn't received any mail from her in 42 days or something like that, and then the very next letter you read, he says, "I received all of your letters at once."
JC, this is really interesting. We see very clearly that the censors have been at work on some of these letters, of course, during wartime, a lot of things that you don't want to risk getting out. Here's one from Laura to Lloyd, dated Cedar Rapids, June 17th, 1945, from Laura to Lloyd. When I got back from Des Moines last night, your letter of May 26th with waiting for me, I'm so happy about that letter. Any letter from you is good. But when you know your letter is being censored, it wasn't opened at the post either, you don't write as personally. So this is the first uncensored letter, and it seemed more like you were telling me secrets. That is good. I can't operate on a monologue forever. So wars these days, we have emails, we have the internet. This is back in a day when you waited weeks for letters from your loved ones going back and forth over the Atlantic in this case.
Yeah, and that's what makes this special. Today we take for granted the wonders of communication. Yeah, they wrote letters back and forth, and like she describes in her letter, you don't always get them. It takes a while to get them, and so receiving that letter made her ecstatic just to know he was still alive and still responding to her. It's a really neat story, and it's complemented by a lot of really cool artifacts. One of the highlights is a piece from a German tank.
We'll put a picture of that on our website, too. It looks like a piece of a German tank with a viewing apparatus. What part is that?
Well, that's the thing. We're not exactly sure what part it is. And that's one of our goals this summer, is to get people to help identify this as well as their own stories from family members in World War II.
And a really interesting connection I'm seeing in the note on that piece taken from a German tank. It says, this device was removed from a German tank by James A. Leach, father of former U.S. Representative and NEH chairman, current University of Iowa law professor, James Leach. It turns out that his father served with General Patton in the European theater in World War II. So it's very, very interesting. J.C. Gillette, thank you very much. Mobile museum educator. You'll be driving this giant mobile museum around Iowa in the coming year?
Oh, absolutely. Where it goes, I go. And I'm excited. And I want to get out and I want to meet every Iowan that I can. We're going to be all over, like you said, RAGBRAI, State Fair, and many more.
J.C. Gillette, thanks very much for the conversation.
Thank you.
Finishing up the hour on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, here's one question. A one-question quiz to test your knowledge of Iowa in popular culture. What film from the late 1980s made these lines famous?
Hey! Is this heaven?
No. It's Iowa.
Kevin Costner there delivering that line from the movie Field of Dreams. Now, this popular Hollywood film gave birth to Iowa's most iconic movie site in the city of Dyersville. It also ushered in a long, bitter legal battle. Joining me to talk about that, Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, with us again. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Ben. How are you doing?
Very well. Before you get to the ruling, tell us, what was the dispute?
Well, that, you know, that magical little ball diamond in the middle of rural Iowa near Dyersville has, you know, kind of been dogged with disputes from the start amongst neighbors and townsfolk. You know, how do we manage this thing that has become such a tourist draw? This specifically centered on a group of neighbors, about 20 neighbors, the Residential and Agricultural Advisory Committee, they called themselves. And they had disputes with the new owners of the ballpark from Chicago, who planned to turn the land surrounding the Field of Dreams into a touring sports complex for, you know, youth baseball and softball teams. But the way the dispute ended up coming to court was the coalition of neighbors suing the city for improperly annexing and then rezoning the Field of Dreams and the surrounding farm from agricultural to commercial.
Mm-hmm. And so the coalition of neighbors, to put it simply, wanted it to stay more or less as it is and not be commercially developed.
Yeah, I mean, one simple explanation would be that they saw a Disneyland being built in their backyard when they didn't sign up for that, living where they do, even though there was this existing tourist draw. In their view, part of the whole reason for it was the fact that it's just a simple ball diamond in the middle of a cornfield on a farmstead with nothing else around it. Mm-hmm. So you build up all this infrastructure, they say, and that's not fair to the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So what did the district court judge rule in this case?
Well, he ruled with the city. So basically, the city was fully sustained in everything it had done with its planning and zoning board, with the city council vote. You know, there was nothing improper. There was nobody was coerced to vote one way or another. It was just so the city fully won the Judge Bittner's ruling in district court in Dubuque. So, you know, everything that the neighbors alleged, they were going to have to appeal if they want to take this any further.
I wanted to play a little clip from the film featuring James Earl Jones in a fabulous soliloquy here, very stirring here, and then sort of get your reaction, your reflections on, well, the irony of what he's saying, but also the way this film touched Americans and I guess the world. Let's hear this.
Ray, when the bank opens in the morning, they'll foreclose.
People will come, Ray.
You're broke, Ray. You sell now or you lose everything.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It's been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, is a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good, and it could be again.
What a scene, James Earl Jones. Powerful. Kyle Munson, I'll give you a moment to shake off those goose pimples and and also the tear from your eye. What has made this film touch so many people, become what it has become? What did you say a quarter century later?
Yeah, no, that is a beautiful moment in the film, and James Earl Jones still loves that as well. Well, I mean, obviously Field of Dreams or, you know, W.P. Kinsella, you know, who wrote the original story that's based on, they didn't invent this whole notion of baseball as a metaphor for life, but it kind of does crystallize that nicely in such a very personal, simple, touching, you know, kind of rural fable. Somebody like Kevin Costner, when, you know, we connected with him last year during the 25th anniversary celebration, and, you know, he said it's, you know, film, this is a film that makes men weep. You know, you have that father-son connection or sense of loss or that wistful longing to have a reconnection with your, you know, your parents. That's central to it. This is what Hollywood does so well over and over, or tries to, right? You know, this whole notion of chase your dreams, follow your dreams, and this film definitely has a heavy strain of that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in Iowa, we also relate to this whole connection with the land. This here is a specific spot, a peaceful, you know, rural shrine to your dreams, to that notion of family, what's important. I mean, all that has just sustained what was kind of a simple film that was not a blockbuster initially, but, and, you know, we're not sitting here talking about the movie Twister, which made millions more dollars, and it also was filmed in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about this because it's really kind of continued to echo and build through the years. So, you know, anytime as a journalist I've been at the field in, you know, in recent years, you run into somebody from Chicago, from Hawaii, from wherever, and it's still, and they still come to kind of echo what, you know, what that monologue was saying, what James Earl Jones was saying there. They come for whatever that sense of peace or stillness is that they're looking for, you know.
Right. Your words, ironic at this point, a film that makes men weep. Perhaps we should change that, a film that makes lawyers weep.
Well, and, you know, and that was kind of baked into the script from the start, too. Obviously, you know, with, you know, the Costner, the character's brother-in-law there telling him to just sign the damn papers and sell the thing.
Right.
So then shortly after the, you know, once the film was kind of starting to kind of create its legend and the field was saved, initially it was partially plotted up, but then saved, there were disputes, you know, from, there were split ownership of the field amongst neighbors. And then finally, one, you know, just the Lansings owned the field themselves for a long time, but it is churned with that sort of dispute as well. So it's had the magic and it's had the mess from the beginning.
Kyle Munson, we'll check in with you on the next update that we need from the Field of Dreams. Thanks so much, Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Thanks, Kyle.
You bet. Take care.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.